Well, welcome to Hope Leads. I'm Wes Lane. You know, a lot of people feel overwhelmed, stuck, and confused, and this podcast is designed to give you hope and perspective so that you can live a powerfully relevant life. Because within the context of a loving and relentlessly purposeful God, we believe your best days are still ahead of you. I'm joined by my delightful co-host, Taylor West. Thanks for coming today.
What an intro. Delightful. I like it.
Thanks for stepping from the next room into this room. Yes.
Thank you for having me, Wes. I love sitting in here and being able to chat with you about all of our incredible guests that we have on. So today we are talking to Dr. Chan Hellman. So he's a science fella. So let's talk a little bit about
science fella. He would be a science fella. yep.
Let's talk about science with you growing up. Did you have what was your favorite science project as a kid, Wes?
That's an interesting question that I'm not sure I have a good answer for. Because
our listeners need to know.
And I was a first class nerd, but I even had a chemistry set. I remember having that back out in the day. You know, back in those days, they'd give you stuff that would blow stuff up. I mean the stuff they'd give you, there
they
was not the sensitivity to children harming themselves like it is today. And so I had access to all kinds of stuff. But
that's
so typically
trouble.
My biggest science experiment was, you know, I'd build model airplanes. And I know there is going to be the listener out there that's going to think, oh my gosh, where were your parents? I mean, I was blowing up. I build model airplanes and I'd blow them up.
I'd
play by myself.
Up?
There was nobody in the neighborhood to play with. I was by myself.
Oh.
And my sister wasn't going to do this stuff with me. And so I'd build model airplanes and I'd pretend I'd be in dog fights and then I'd blow them up with black cat.
You're right. So someone's wondering, and it's me, where was your mother,
Wesley?
Where
was your mother? Well, we lived on 3 acres, and so it's amazing how far you can get away from
She trusted
mom.
You a lot more than she should
have. That's right. Yes.
All right. So today, with having Dr. Chan Hellman on the podcast, we're talking about his book, Hope Rising. So in the podcast, he's saying something that nobody's talking about, that hope is a science.
Yeah.
He's him being the science fella.
This is profound.
Yes. Yeah. So, Wes, what does it mean that hope is a science?
Well, I think when I first heard Chan some months ago, I went to a presentation he was doing on the subject of hope, and it just blew me away. Because what I'd always heard of was the phrase, "Well, hope is not a strategy." Mm-hmm. You know, it's kind of like this. Pollyanna, you know, hope, come on. What's a plan? Give me a plan. You know, what Chan utterly destroyed was the myth that hope is not a strategy. Hope is in fact a strategy. In fact, he talks about all the childhood trauma and all the things that are besetting our kids and how there are pathways out there. So there are people that are listening that will listen to this podcast that will be so encouraged because they are the discouraged, the confused, life's got me stumped right now.
Yeah.
Where am I going? Well, he talks about how to generate. There is a science to generating hope within ourselves and within a workplace, your own family, a community. And it's just life-giving. I can't wait for
absolutely.
People to hear this.
Yeah, so he talks about how how hope has a power to change people's lives. So is this something that you've always believed, or is it something that's changed since you've gotten to know Chan?
Well, I've always believed that hope. You know, there's a statement we use with SALT, and that we want our leaders that are a part of our SALT program to recognize that one of our responsibilities as a leader is to kindle and fan an extravagant hope within the hearts of others. I mean, that's what sustains a movement, which is what we see ourselves as being a part of. And so hope's already been there. What I didn't realize was that there was a science to it. And this is such a great hope having been created by God.
Mm-hmm.
And it's so fascinating to see how science then comes along and shows there is such a strong connectivity to us in our need as human beings to have hope. Why hope is the single most important indicator for one's well-being.
Mm, yeah.
Now that's profound.
Yeah,
so
it is.
Anyway, it's great stuff. People are gonna love it. They're gonna just love this conversation.
Well, I am pumped for our audience to hear the science and power of hope.
Here is my conversation with Dr. Chan Hellman. Dr. Chan Hellman, what a privilege to have you on board today. I have been so excited to have you come and spend some time on our podcast, Hope Leads. When I met you last summer, I had been invited to come and hear a lecture. Now, I get invited to a lot of stuff, and I didn't really know what to expect, but a friend had invited me, and so I felt, I'll go. Well, you blew my mind. I mean, oh my gosh, I felt like the Queen of Sheba. The half had not been told me, and you blew up something that I had not been aware of. Because, you know, as a background, so SALT, we speak a lot about calling leaders who are followers of Jesus to be what I would call a hope evangelist. In other words, we ask them to kindle and fan an extravagant hope in the heart of others about a different city, a city that, you know, just like we believe that God sees us not as we are, but as we could be. So he sees an accumulation of humans in one place. You see, it's a city, and we as a city can be a different place. And so when I heard you blow up the lie that I didn't know was a lie until I heard you, which is, well, hope is not a strategy. I could have broken out and dance right there. So thank you for that. And we're going to break, you know, we're going to unpack that today, but, so welcome.
Thank you. It's an honor to be here. Thank you.
You know, the other day I received and before we unpack that, the other day I received a quote from somebody. It was in a morning devotional. A friend said, and he said, sent to me, and he said, the only way to get rid of your past is to make a future of it. God will waste nothing. And when I heard that quote, I thought of you and the background, your story, your background of how you came to do what you do now. And so if you would be so kind, because a lot of our listeners, I think, will identify greatly with some aspect of your story. Would you mind just kicking it off with that?
Sure. So from about seventh grade through high school, I was homeless. And really experiencing just a tremendous amount of adversity in my life. And it was the relationship that I had with some key teachers and adults who really helped me get through that really difficult time. And I'll just be blunt, a lot of suicidal ideation, a lot of despair. And you know, today, as a professor, somebody who gets to travel pretty frequently, you know, it is those past experiences in my life that really give me meaning and purpose day in and day out for the work that I do, and my interest and passion and hope, and how it transformed my life, and how I see it transforming others' lives in extreme adversity.
Did you realize that you were going to be a hope scientist, if you will? Because you look back, and certainly you didn't at the seventh grade.
You know, I didn't. You know, of course, back then I expected to live to about the age of 25.
That's remarkable. Why did you think you were only going to live to age 25?
Well, I didn't see a future where I mattered. I didn't see, you know, I internalized because of the adversity. You know, we tend to isolate ourselves, and there's a lot of shame associated with those adversities. And so, you know, I always thought of myself as something or someone less than. And so I just went ahead and internalized that and thought, well, if if that's who I am, then I'm going to live that way. And, you know, a lot of bad choices were associated with that expectation. But no, I never expected to be a hope scientist. And, you know, one of the things that I've learned is that, you know, individuals who are lower in hope tend to set avoidant goals. People who are higher in hope tend to set achievement goals. And, you know, going to college was an avoidance of other options. Even when I started to experience success, I never, even through grad school and my PhD program, I would have never thought that I would be studying hope. In fact, in grad school, I probably would have made fun of somebody like me.
But isn't it fascinating, though? I mean, your story is so fascinating in that someone, so you were on a trajectory that changed. And so something had to have, or some series of things had to have taken place that bumped you onto a different path. What might those have been?
Sure. Well, two things stand out really at the forefront of those. In the eighth grade, a group of my friends invited me to attend a church camp. And that really transformed part of my belief in myself and, you know, understanding that I was a child of God and that I was worthy of love. That was very important for me. And at that time in the eighth grade, I undertook reading the entire New Testament.
Man, I didn't do that.
I'm
impressed.
And I read it from an eighth grader's perspective. So, you know, not a lot of depth. But there were a couple of teachers in my life who really helped me transform that I did matter and that I was worthy. And that really started me down the road, even though I didn't realize it at the time. But those significant protective factors were transitional in my life.
But you know, Chan, in your book, and by the way, I've got here with me your book, Hope Rising, which you co-wrote with Casey Gwynn. In fact, Hope Rising is called How the Science of Hope Can Change Your Life, which is just a remarkable story. But one thing that you said, speaking to when we talk about those people that have influenced you, but one thing was really remarkable, and that was the impact that a coach had on you, sitting, just coming over and just speaking to you a simple something. And I say that within the construct of people listening, they think, oh, jump through hoops to have impact. But that's not the truth.
That's absolutely right. You know, the coach knew what I was going through, some of the things that I was going through, and he literally just came and sat down with me in the gym, and he didn't say anything for, you know, 3 or 4 minutes. And you know, towards the end, he just leaned into me, and he stayed there just touching me. And as he started to get up, he's a simple sentence, and he said, "You're going to be okay." And that was it. And, you know, and so for me, if we think about hope as a social gift and how in that moment he gave me the gift of hope, and it was so unintentional, it was so simple, but it transformed my life.
Oh, the power of words.
Absolutely.
You know, life and death is in the power of the tongue, as the Bible talks about. And so this fella came and spoke life to you. And so I just hope that was an inspiration to me as I think about the opportunities that I have to just speak life. And that's not a lecture. That may just be a simple sentence like this coach did with you that oh my gosh.
The critical aspect of hope is grounded in relationships and the relationships that we have with each other. And it was so simple. But imagine if we did that with more intention. Imagine the impact that we could potentially have on countless children's lives. Just unfathomable. I will tell you that I actually met up with that teacher a few years ago and right about the time we were finishing the book. And I shared with him the story and how, you know, that he was the one of the reasons I was alive today. And his response, a beautiful man, his response was, I did what? And I just love that because, again, it shows who he was.
That's right.
You know, and but it also tells me that it doesn't take much to impact somebody's life in such a profound way.
Well, and even as we think about that life and death in the power of the tongue and how a simple sentence can bring life, so a simple sentence can bring death as well. Discouragement.
Despair.
Yeah,
absolutely. The adversity, the blame, absolutely. I recently gave a graduation speech at the university that I did my undergraduate in, and the title of the speech was Second Chances and Grace.
Mm.
And, you know, it's just that my life is just so full of second chances that people have afforded me. And in a time where I felt that I wasn't worthy and didn't deserve it. So, you know, certainly the grace that people have shown me is so important on where I am today.
You know, you'd be interested to know then. So there is a remarkable Oklahoma history book out that the first volume's out and the second volume's going to come out next fall. And he opens the book. In the introduction, he talks about the utter uniqueness of Oklahoma from any other state in the Union. And it was that we were the people showing up. Nobody was here. Well, from the first place, nobody's originally, they weren't here because they didn't want to be. And then the people that show up at a land run are not like big time winners.
And
he talked about, he said, Oklahoma will always and will ever be so very unique because we are a land of second and third chances.
That's right.
It's remarkable.
It is.
Well, so tell us about hope then. I mean, unpack that a little bit. What is hope? Why does it matter? Although we've talked a little bit about why it matters.
Right. Well, so hope is, first of all, hope is the belief that the future will be better than today. And more importantly, that you have the power to make it so. Hope is comprised of three things. First is that the idea that each of us, from the moment we wake up until the moment we go to bed, we are pursuing goals in our life. We are goal-driven. And so goals become the cornerstone of hope, the goals that we desire. What's important about hope is that we have the pathways or the roadmaps by which to achieve those goals, the plan. Pathways thinking also includes our ability to solve problems, to overcome barriers in those pathways. The final component is willpower. It's often referred to as agency in psychological terms, but it's really the willpower that we have to pursue those goals. So hope is about goals, pathway, and willpower. And I think it's important right off the bat for us to understand that just as an example, how often do you use the word hope in everyday use? You know, we're in Oklahoma in January, and you know, I hope it doesn't rain today, for instance.
Yeah.
Or I might pass you in the hall and say, I hope you have a great day.
Yeah.
Or I hope you're well. And really, that's not the correct use of the word hope, because hope requires both pathways and willpower. And if we think about it, when I say, I hope it doesn't rain today, I have a desire. I have willpower for that goal. I just don't have the pathways. And in fact, the definition of a wish is when we have a desire for an outcome, but no control over the outcome. So hope is about action. It's about taking action to achieve your goals.
It's about having, another thing I take away from that is that it's about you have control over some things.
That's right. And it is critical when we think about that definition. You know, the future is going to be better than today and that you have the power to make
it
so.
Yes.
It's not optimism. Although optimism is important, it's that you have the power to make it so. It's about your action. It's about your steps. And granted, in my life, it was nurtured and moved along by important others. But at the end of the day, it's my ability to pursue my pathways.
Well, let's break that down just a little bit, because I know there are a lot of people that are discouraged. They're confused about where they're going. They're really carrying some weight, some chains, let's say, that really they don't need to carry. And so I've been one of those myself. So I'm speaking out of my own experience. Let's break something down into a real simple deal. When we talk about that equation, and you know, when you say that, it reminds me like a chemistry equation. If you put these three ingredients together, you're going to get a whole nother substance. You know, like, you know, two hydrogens and an oxygen, you know, suddenly you got water. So the ability to be a scientist of your own well-being to a degree,
right,
is really significant. And it's not just the circumstance, well, I want to be a millionaire. That'll solve all my problems. Well, what is the pathway? I mean, what are those small victories?
Sure.
That are important.
Yeah, we actually refer to the process as stepping towards our goals. So when I set a goal, let's take a not too distant example from being a millionaire. But let's say that I'm working with a child, and the child in sixth grade says, "I want to be an NBA basketball star." And you know, first of all, we have to in our own minds recognize that is that really hope, or is that a wish, or in fact, is that a fantasy? And the way to make it reality is when we begin to identify the pathways. So what we do is a stepping process. So in order to be an NBA basketball star, what do I have to do? What's that first step, right? And I'm thinking backwards from being an NBA basketball star. Mm-hmm. I have to get drafted.
Mm-hmm.
In order to get drafted, I have to play.
Mm.
In order to play, I have to be on a competitive team. In order to be on a competitive team, and then I just keep stepping that back. And pretty soon, being in school is a pathway to the goal of being an NBA basketball star. So for a child who may be apathetic towards school, our goal would be to help them find that school is, in fact, a pathway to the goals they desire.
Well, so even a listener that might not be that's a great example, by the way. I mean, you're just breaking it down into, you know, it's like I heard my mom say, how does Robert eat the elephant? You know, one bite at a time.
Right.
And so that's what you're just creating bite-size opportunities for those small victories of encouragement.
That's right. You know, earlier you were talking about, you know, the chains and the burdens that we may carry. And, you know, some of the things we've learned in our research is that, you know, individuals who have experienced trauma and adversity in their lives, their goal setting tends to be very short term. Thinking long term becomes rather difficult. And I refer to that as survival hope, because I'm just trying to get through today. But, you know, oftentimes we set goals, and those goals can be so overwhelming. And so we really have to lean into that stepping process. Every time you think of a step, you also have to have in your mind this idea, or perhaps a mantra of, is that step too big?
Mm.
And if that step is too big, then break it down even smaller. And for high trauma individuals, people experiencing a lot of adversity, what we really have to do is make sure that what I do the moment I walk out this door is the first step in achieving my goals, because hope begets hope. And that is such a critical framework.
So I remember sitting in my, I totally blew my life up in my late 20s. I managed through my own personal challenges to end up having a wife leave me. I am now $250,000 in debt. I'm sitting in a dumpy apartment in North Oklahoma City, and GMAC is calling me wanting my truck back. There was not going to be any finger snap getting out of that. That was a process, bit by bit, piece by piece, And so for you who's listening to this right now, I just know that so many of you are struggling with stuff like that. And maybe just like Chan has just said, maybe you need to break it down even smaller and start experiencing some victories. Because otherwise, oh my gosh, you're setting yourself up for failure.
Yeah, that's right. That's right.
Well, you've mentioned trauma several times. That in your book was another remarkable thing. Would you explain? In fact, I just started hearing this phrase about childhood trauma and the impact of trauma only recently. I mean, I ran a juvenile division for 6 years ago for the district attorney's office. We dealt with kids and all kinds of problems and challenges and stuff like that. But I just never remember anybody talking about breaking it down in the trauma they experienced. It just right. was not a conversation point.
Well, I think historically the way that we've thought about our own trauma or even working with others, because we just didn't have the background, was, you know, that people just need to suck it up. People just need to toughen up and get over it. But you know, the science of the Adverse Childhood Experiences Study, for instance, which is probably the most well-known framework for childhood trauma, it's only 20 years old. It's not very old at all. But the Adverse Childhood Experiences Study identifies 10 adverse events that occur or can occur during a child's life. And the research is just very clear that the more adversities that a child experiences, then exponentially the difficulty they will have physically, psychologically, and socially, including an increase in criminality. So one study recently in Florida identified that 100% of the individuals, youth who are adjudicated statewide, have an ACE score of 1 or higher. 100%. There is not one youth in that system that hasn't had at least one childhood adversity.
You know, and this is utterly fascinating. And again, as a prosecutor, we were a lot of times really immune. We were not, when somebody would be talking about, well, this kid's had a really tough, you know, blah, 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 we're going to go, oh, come on. And really, I mean, we wanted to try to help, especially in the juvenile world, we wanted to help. By the time, you know, we're in the adult criminality, it's like, well, there's just choices. These are choices you make. What I and my compadres were not aware of were, wow, how things just really, you know, it's like a series of streams that ultimately become a torrential flood.
Right.
So I'm looking here in your book, and you actually have a sample of, you've got the 10 questions.
Right.
Did you know it doesn't take a majority to create change? All you need is 10% of the population and change happens. Hope Culture is a community building a movement to create a life of hope for every person in this community. You don't have to just talk about hope. You can wear hope, because Hope Culture's beautiful apparel line does just that. In this revolution, Hope Culture is the flag you wear. Go to Hope Culture, that's one word, hopeculture.us. For every item you take home from the Hope Culture apparel line, 50% goes back to the city. So go today and join the 10% of the people leading the charge, the 10% who speak with their lives. Hope is the culture. Go to hopeculture.us. That's hopeculture.us. Let's go back to my conversation with Dr. Chan Hellman. But Oklahoma is number one in the country for having a score of 4 or above, which is shocking.
It's absolutely shocking. It's absolutely shocking.
And then you look at this, and then you show on the other side of the page, you talk about what you're more likely to do when you've got that kind of score. And so 3,600% more likely to become involved, to become an injection drug heroin user, 1,200% greater likelihood of attempting suicide, 1,200% more likely to be a sexual assault victim. You know, on and on, the list goes on of not good stuff.
Right, right. Profound impact. The science behind the adverse childhood experiences is without question. And the fact that the state of Oklahoma ranks number one in the nation. But I will say this as well. The national research, as well as certainly research in Oklahoma, only about a third of the population has an ACE score of zero. Most of us have experienced at least one of those adversities. Back to your point is that Oklahoma just has the highest rate of adversity for children.
Any sense of why?
You know, I think it's a very complex question. You know, high poverty, high stress rates. I think intergenerational related trauma. We're actually seeing some data that shows that youth today are experiencing trauma at a rate higher than the generation before. So, you know, I think that's what the childhood trauma researchers are still trying to unpack. Our work is really trying to understand, so what do we do about that? And I'm convinced in our research that hope is what you do about that. Hope is the response.
Well, hope, fear plays such a role with trauma. I mean, well, you can't read those 10 things and not just shudder at living in a household experience like that. Well, you think about your own background.
Right. Yeah, I'm a score of 8 out of those 10.
Oh my gosh.
That you say. And you know what? One of the things that we've learned, I suppose one of the benefits of having that level of adversity is that it gives me a lot of research questions that I go and explore.
But you have the fascinating intersection of being involved in something that's answering some of your own questions.
That's absolutely right. The power of hope is just unremarkable in the way that it changes the trajectory of a child's life, right? Because to your point earlier, what does a rage-filled youth become?
Say that again?
What does a rage-filled youth become?
Oh, yeah, right.
And a rage-filled youth becomes an adult who enters into our system and creates havoc around them.
Yeah.
And so we have to find strategies to interrupt that framework.
Go ahead.
Well, I was just going to say one of the profound things about the adverse childhood experiences is that if you have an ACE score of 6 or higher, your life expectancy is 20 years less than if you have an ACE score of 0.
Mm.
And we conducted a study 2 years ago in Tulsa where we looked at a city of hope or a culture of hope, so to speak. And one of the things that we found is that higher hope scores were associated with higher life expectancies. So even in the presence of these childhood traumas, if we can nurture hope, we can change the trajectory of a child or an adult's life.
Well, and I've heard talk just in this city how there are zip codes that in which the life expectancy in that zip code is shockingly lower than in other parts of town.
That's right. Well, and if you look at those communities, you know, you'll start to see patterns. Tulsa has a very similar framework that Oklahoma City has, and you know, you're seeing a food desert in those communities, lack of development, you know, youth with fairly limited opportunities for social connectedness in meaningful ways.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, what does a rage-filled youth become? And I think we have to be very intentional in telling a child they're going to be okay.
Well, and I think about when you use the word rage, that continuum, hope continuum, you know, beginning. So there's hope, then there's the next step of rage. And then people think that despair is the opposite of hope, but it's not. It's apathy.
Right, right. So if we think about the process of becoming hopeless, so how that takes place is that if I have a goal that I desire, and that goal is being significantly blocked, then I'm going to experience the emotional reaction of anger or even rage. And for some in our communities, rage has helped us overcome those barriers.
Mm.
However, if that rage doesn't propel me beyond the barrier and ultimately I decide that I can't achieve my goal, then I begin to experience despair. And I think it's important for us to remember that despair is, though very important, is still part of hope. Because despair is about urgency. It's that hope is starting to leave me. Mm-hmm. That is that in order for me to achieve my goals, luck or other people are going to now have to become involved. Now, remember our definition, right? Hope is the belief that tomorrow will be better and that I have the power to make it so. So we have to start thinking about what does desperation look like?
Oh, that's good. It could be the very act of being in despair that causes one to reach out for help.
That's right.
You know, you talk about, we talked about the measurability of childhood trauma, but hope is also measurable as well.
That's right. Hope is easily measured. I'm a quantitative psychologist by training, which means that my PhD is in statistics and research methods. And I am absolutely convinced that I can measure anything. I am.
There's a story, in fact. I just made me think of it, how you even got set on this course of what you're doing right now.
That's right. When I was asked by an organization to present on outcomes assessments, I was talking about our work at the university of working with human service nonprofit organizations to measure their outcomes. And in that meeting, I flippantly made a comment that I was also interested in hope. And a significant person in the audience looked at me and said, "You can't measure that."
I dare you.
Yeah. And I'm very competitive, by the way.
Yeah. So much for this comment. I'm sure you share this with this person later.
Oh, absolutely. No. Absolutely. In fact, we're having coffee soon. but hope is, it's easily measured. We do have a children's hope scale. It's it's a self-report, six-item scale that measures both pathways and willpower. And it's validated for children ages 7 to 17. And then the adult hope scale is for individuals over the age of 17. Our group has actually conducted multiple research studies demonstrating its solid validity and reliability, even in translation to other languages. The measure holds up really, really well.
Well, isn't it interesting that I was actually inspired by this when I read this, just for example, a children's hope score. It's like you can come in and these questions are things like, I think I'm doing well. There's a scale, of 1 to 6 on a scale of 1 to 6. I think I'm doing pretty well, or I can think of many ways to get the things in life that are most important to me, or I'm doing just as well as other kids my age, on and on. But what's so interesting is that you think about this within the context of children in our elementary schools, right, and the ability to discern whether that classroom is a classroom that's hope infused.
Right.
Just, you could take a test. You could, this real simple quiz at the beginning, and you could do this every week, every day if you wanted.
That's right.
In the morning and then when we're leaving, and just check the scores.
Right. Interestingly enough, children's hope scores are significant predictors of their academic achievement. It's associated with attendance, the grades in high school, which courses they are electives that they enroll in. It is a better predictor of first-year college performance than the SAT, ACT, or high school GPA.
Well, that'd be music to a lot of people's ears who are like the big movement.
Right.
Unseat all that stuff. Just take, give them a hope test.
Well, if empirically it works, it works.
Now that's interesting. You might be, who knows what's going to come out of this? Well, the body of knowledge that has been unloading here of late, I'm just wondering what is the, I always think about from a biblical perspective, you know, the what is the relationship between faith and hope? And in Hebrews 11:1, faith is the convictions of things. Or I'm sorry, it's the substance of things hoped for, the conviction of things not seen. And what do you think about that? Is the, I read also somewhere that people that are hope filled have some that hope is rooted in faith. And I'm not talking about religious faith necessarily, but whatever it is that, whether I have faith in someone or something, or what's your thought on all that?
Sure. I've been very interested in the relationship between faith and hope for several years now, just in my own personal journey, in faith, and just, you know, in and out of that journey. And, you know, I will say this, that I believe that my faith in Christ is the moral compass that helps me determine which goals I value and which pathways are righteous. So I think that faith is really the mindset that drives my hope framework. The other aspect of that is that my faith in the resurrection and my faith in Christ, it also sustains me, my willpower and my energy, even in times of just extreme adversity where I maybe don't see a pathway, but I still know that no matter what happens, that my future, my life will get better. So I think that there's a really important intersection between faith and hope.
I think that's really a fascinating thought. I mean, it's like, so if I'm in a place of discouragement, I don't have any hope going, but faith can almost like be a bridge. Even though I don't see a pathway right then, it's what sustains me until I do.
You know, if you think about maybe a strategy that can help, you know, when my goals are significantly blocked and I don't see a pathway out of this adversity, and I'm starting to transition into despair, or maybe I'm living in despair, you know, in that context, the scripture itself becomes a pathway for well-being, because it can help calm me. It can help remind me that that there are those who love me, that I am a child of God and worthy of the righteousness associated with that. You know, some of the research that we've done is looking at when individuals are in crisis, their willpower is just completely in chaos. And what are strategies to help people resolve that chaos? And we've published several studies on this, looking at mindfulness practice, which can include prayer. So I do think that there's a significant intersection between faith and hope. And I don't think that there has to be any type of conflict between the science of hope and the faith in Christ.
Boy, I see so many people all the time, just from the nature of the work we do with leadership development, you know, people in business or government or education, the arts, or wherever they come from, that are followers of Jesus, but their whole identity is rooted in far less than who God sees them as being. And as we've been talking about for the last, you know, 30 minutes, that has consequences. And not understanding who we are can be really debilitating. So let's talk about the proliferation of hope. This, as I've told you before, I've just been fascinated by watching this. Well, you've got to be just so stimulated as to be like, I can't take any more of this. It's so good. It's like watching this. You're watching the fruit being now growing from having been cultivating this soil a long time. And so all over the place, we're seeing these. I saw a film, maybe, I don't know, two, 3 months ago, a documentary called Resilience, talking about childhood trauma and one thing or another. I've you know, in your book, you talk about, I mean, your co-author here, Casey Gwynn, and the creation of hope camps. Hope camps?
Right. Well, you know, the fundamental thing to remember is that hope can be learned. Hope can be taught.
Yeah.
Even with a history of trauma and adversity. And Camp Hope is a program across, there's two camps here in Oklahoma. Palomar, locally here in Oklahoma mm-hmm. City, has.
Oh, they have a Hope Camp?
They do. Mm-hmm. And with the passage of the MAPS program, uh-huh. It'll have a significant impact on the way they run camps.
I didn't know that.
Right. And so Camp Hope is identified for children who have been exposed to domestic violence, ages 6 through 17. And the program itself, it's a week-long camp. It's not a therapeutic camp at all. It's a challenge-by-choice camp. But the curriculum is completely grounded in the hope language. And we see tremendous gains in a child's hope scores just in 1 week of intervention. What's also important for that is that our research demonstrates that that hope is sustained the following year and has significant impact on their academic achievement. Do you know that raising a child's hope score by 2 points will predict a letter grade change in the classroom? And so, you know, Camp Hope has a tremendous, tremendous potential for our communities. But, you know, you're absolutely right. I'm in complete awe of where we are as a state right now, mm-hmm. where we are watching Oklahoma City from just up the road a little. We are in such a special, special time in our state and a special opportunity. And it's my hope. I won't say a wish.
Because there's a pathway.
There is a pathway.
And an agency, a willpower.
Yes, absolutely. but I believe that hope is, it offers a language that can unify leaders across vast disciplines to come together and have a common language for achieving great things in our city and our state.
Oh, Jen, I couldn't agree with you more. And that was what was so exciting to me last summer. Like, oh my gosh, anyway. So Palomar, let's say someone's listener is a listener and they're a parent who's in a domestic violence circumstance and they've got a child. I mean, how do they get their child enrolled?
Sure.
In that?
Palomar is a local family justice center located here in Oklahoma City. So a parent can certainly reach out to Palomar directly. Mm-hmm. A parent can work with a school counselor. A school counselor can reach out or, you know, other members of the community. Excuse me. But it's just a profound, the evidence is just so strong. And so consistent.
Well, and so as we think about the listener right now, who, I mean, there are so many different levels of how they can be, and they just come up with this hope evangelism, a hope evangelist. And I don't mean that from like a religious deal. I'm talking about the sharing hope with everyone. But not only, I mean, so not only have we talked about, for the listener who is thinking about, okay, for me personally, this is I see the formula. Heck, I could go out and get a Chance book, Hope Rising. There are pathways I can help myself on that. But there are also people who might wonder, how do I help my family be a hope-filled family or my workplace be a hope-filled workplace? What does that look like?
Sure, and that is something I've been very interested in for the last couple of years, is this idea of collective hope. And if hope is really good for each of us individually, what does it look like when we share hope in our community, however that might be defined? And so, you know, we have to have faith and belief that we can set a common goal and that collectively we can identify the strategies or the pathways. Doing it in a group setting can be very powerful because you may think of pathways, for instance, that I had never thought of, and we can share those. Mm-hmm. In that framework, I actually refer to that as hope modeling. Who are the people in our lives and our communities who model hope? And I don't mean that in a very abstract way. I mean, goal setting, pathways development, and willpower. And So there are very specific steps, and it starts with goal setting. What is our vision for the future? And then how do we begin to bring people together to begin to discuss those strategies? I quite frankly think that a lot of conflict that goes on in our state, in our nation, is not that we differ so much in the goals that we set, more so the pathways we think are the ones that are the right ones to get there. And the beauty of that is that, you know, what may be a pathway for you is a goal for me. And I'll give you an example of that. A good friend of mine, his goal is to get his teenage son to mow the yard. And his son doesn't share that goal.
Yeah.
So my friend realizes that giving his son $20 is a pathway to achieving that goal. Now his son's goal is to get $20. And his son's pathway is to mow the yard.
I like that. I wish I'd had that option. Nobody was consulting me on what the pathway of choice would have been.
Right. Nurturing hope.
That's right, nurturing hope. So are you seeing now more purposeful conversations in schools and offices about how we go about that?
Very much so. There are multiple school districts in the state I'm now working with very intentionally of creating hope navigators in the school system. Uh-huh. People who are trained to understand, to see hope, to measure it, to help create a culture of hope in the schools. Several of our state agencies are now intentionally moving towards becoming a hope-centered organization. Department of Human Services is the first yeah. agency of many to come, I believe.
Hey, that's a huge deal.
It
right
is.
There.
It really is. And you know, the language of hope itself, it just allows individuals across tremendous differences in discipline to come together and have a shared language. Right? Mm-hmm. It's a common language for collective impact. It really is.
Well, in fact, one time I asked you, I said, "What?" So what is a city of hope? What does a city of hope look like? And you talked about that three things needed to be cultivated. First of all, an awareness of hope as a matter that we should care about. And then there's a common language. What is the common language of hope as you just talked about? And then finally, hope becoming a value that is actually known, that is actually sought. We know this is something we should pursue. That
I believe that's right, you know, and that's really the framework of my research and my work for the last 10 plus years is, you know, we can create an awareness of the language of it, but you know, recognizing that hope is a valued characteristic, and the reason that we want to recognize its value is because it is the single best predictor of well-being for both children and adults. Single best predictor.
I mean, that's worth repeating. Hope is the single best predictor for the well-being of humans.
That's right. Absolutely. And so if we can agree that it is the valued concept, right, it is the thing that we are here to do, to nurture hope in our city, in our communities, then it's beginning to, you know, create smart solutions, create smart pathways by which to achieve that. And they may not be all the same in various neighborhoods, but the common language can drive and unite.
Well, and speaking of that, you know, just as an example of the listener went, well, golly, where do you begin? And I don't want to leave our conversation without identifying. You had mentioned there are people that are actually in schools and they're going about specific processes of how to know how to nurture hope. Well, they're getting that information from somewhere, that training.
So I'm doing training in the school system. So we're building trauma-informed and hope-centered schools.
Okay.
A simple example with the school, and the simplicity of hope is just profound. So within one school, they They identified everybody, every child in sixth grade, for instance, and they brought all the teachers and the counselors in a room, and they listed every child, and they asked the teachers and the counselors very simply, if you know this child, when we read their name, raise your hand. And lo and behold, there were 30 children in that school who nobody knew.
Whoa.
Now, think about the youth who have moved 7, 8, 9 times in a semester. You know, there's a lot of reasons for why they may not be known. But the school intentionally said, every teacher volunteered, every teacher is going to pick one child and reach out 20 minutes a day. They're just going to reach out to that child that nobody knew. And it's just bringing that child into recognizing that they are worthy. It's that intentional framework of nurturing hope.
It's the coach coming and taking a seat, and it's actually broader than that.
Right, right.
I just got to mention this group because this is so exciting when we talk about creating a culture of hope in a city. A group, and this is a part of what you've been inspiring to take place. So a group of 5 of our SALT alum were 3 African Americans and 2 white guys, and they're all friends, and they're talking about this issue of kindling and fanning and extravagant hope. They're talking about the stuff that you're talking about, and out of organically out of one meeting like 3 months ago, I guess it was in the fall or early, they come up with an idea. And it's based upon the different giftednesses of them. They all throw in their different giftedness and they create this thing called hopeculture.us. And what it is they've created a business, a company, in which they are putting out clothing lines. There's a whole clothing line. You can go to hopeculture.us and see that there's a whole clothing line that's all about hope and hope culture. Their goal is to achieve a tipping point in the community that common awareness, because of the logos and the language that's on the clothing, it's doing what you're talking about. It's creating a common language. It's doing an awareness, but we recognize that a tipping point of culture is when 10% of a community come to a strongly held belief that something matters, and they're committed to that, and that changes everything. And so when we think about hope, one thing that gives me hope is that change for the good is not dependent upon 50% plus one vote. It is 10% of a community can change everything. And so these guys and their very unique methodology are saying, here's what we can do to throw down on this city and other places to have a different culture than it has at this moment. And that's just very exciting. And so if you're listening right now and you're wondering, gee, what do I do? What do I do? Well, don't put yourself in despair by creating a hope plan that's like insurmountable. You know, just start small. What's it look like in your family? How do you go about get Chan's book and understand this thing? I don't know if there's other practical things that they can do. What would you suggest?
Well, let's start this way. How about identify one thing you want to achieve this week and write that down. Write one thing. That you would like to, one goal you would like to achieve, whether it's personal or professional, and then just simply list what is one step you can take today to move towards that goal. And that begins the stepping process. And if you truly believe and understand that hope begets hope, that opportunity for that first step success is going to make the future possible. Mm. And it's that simple.
Well, you have infused me with hope just by getting the opportunity to sit down with you. You have laid the case that hope is a strategy, and we can win with that.
Absolutely.
So, Dr. Chan Hellman, thank you so much for being on Hope Leads today. Even the name of this broadcast, even the name of this is inspired by Chan Hellman. Thank you so much. Kind.
What an honor. Thank you very much.
So let me give you some concluding thoughts. If Hope were a person in the room, what would she say to us? Well, I think, first of all, she'd say that you are fearfully and wonderfully made, that an unchanging God designed, built you, and sent you into a moment of history as part of his loving strategy to transform a chaotic world and make it good again. You are called as change agents. Hope would tell you that she flourishes when we listen to God and set goals for our lives that press us further toward becoming that person God has always been willing for us to become. Hope would tell you to set action steps towards achieving those goals. They don't have to be giant steps. Start with baby steps so you can be encouraged along the way. But Hope would also tell you that you've got to not just make plans to step, but you must exercise the willpower to just take that next right step. Step by step by step gets you to the destination God has for your life. It's the long obedience in the same direction. And finally, Hope would tell you that God sees us not as we are, but as we could become if we will dare. It's the same for our communities. As followers of Jesus, you are a sent people, and all humans should flourish because God's kids are in town. What evil thing dies because you exist? No one else is coming. You're the generation sent to your community in this moment. You're it. Press into God's purposes for your lives, and you will discover that hope abounds and that Jesus is still the God of the impossible. Thank you for joining us today on Hope Leads. I'm Wes Lane. Once again, I'd be honored if you would take a moment to rate this podcast, review it, subscribe, and share it with someone who needs hope. We want to thank Brianna Gaither for the song I Won't Rest Until from her album Vanity. Remember, you are fearfully and wonderfully made by a God who is willing for us to live meaningful lives of profound impact. I invite you to just show up and watch God show off. Like a-